You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Eric Asimov. We'll talk to Eric about what else, wine, the year ahead, and a lot more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Eric Asimov is the longtime wine critic of the New York Times. His wine column, The Pour, appears every Wednesday in the food section of the Times, in print and online. Eric recently concluded almost 9 years and 100 columns of his wine school. Post-COVID times have allowed Eric to travel around the world, taste wine, and meet the winemakers for the first time in years. He's published numerous books about wine and shares the torture of the New York Jets with me. Welcome back to the Grape Nation, Eric.
Great to see you, Sam.
So it's great to have you as our first guest of the new year, 2023, for the Grape Nation. And I couldn't think of anyone better to kick.
But did you have to mention the Jets?
Well, so I just blew the whole vibe, right? We're both. Well, we don't have to worry about Sunday's game. You know,
that's
true.
Doesn't
mean
that's
anything.
True.
We don't want to get into that. I'm glad our friend Gary Vaynerchuk's not around. He would have probably thrown the mic against the wall. I was towards the end of last year, I was putting together this year, and I was thinking, you know, what type of guests? The show has morphed into really the story, not the biggest wine, the best wine, the most obvious stuff. There's some great stories there. And you and I have sat down in Charleston a bunch of times. You've been on the show before. And when I think about stories, great stories, people, that's what you do. You're a story crafter, you're a storyteller, you're an information messenger. So I thought it would be fun, to sit down and kind of frame the year with you. But I'd spoken to you off air about this, and I wanted to talk to you about it a little. You know, since COVID has subsided, and God knows where it is today. I mean, we're not out of the woods. But you were able to do some traveling. I want you to tell me about some of the destinations, you know, who you met, what you tasted. And are these subjects of upcoming columns? Did you meet anybody that really wowed you, you know, that's memorable? I remember the last time you were on, you were just in love with Chianti Classico as a value.
I still am.
Right. As, you know, as a value, quality to value and all of that, you know. So what's sort of the next thing? So tell me a little, before we get into things, tell me a little about your travels. Because literally, like I said, you sat around for 2 years.
You know, it wasn't quite 2 years. And I actually started traveling again in the summer of 2021 when we were all vaccinated and we thought, okay, you know, we're past this. And
right.
No. Started again in the spring of 22 and actually did a lot of traveling, but found myself, especially in the early part of the year, in situations that seemed to me to be super spreader events. And I had COVID pretty badly before I was vaccinated and lost my sense of smell or had it muffled for a long time.
Oof.
And so I started to get a little paranoid and retreated from the traveling and didn't go anywhere for a long time until just recently when I was in the UK for a while. But I was in California multiple times, actually, did a bunch of wine events around the country, was up in Vermont, was in Burgundy for the first time in a few years, which was great.
Was Burgundy
fun.
An event thing or just visiting
no,
and
that
tasting?
No, that was for, I did a couple of stories right. when I was there. Right. I did a piece on Savigny-les-Bains. And also a vineyard up in Ficin that in the 19th century was regarded as the equivalent of a Grand Cru and is now somewhat forgotten.
Who is it?
Clos des Perrières.
Okay.
And it's really quite a good wine, and the guy, the head of the family currently, who's owned that place for a long time, is intent on bringing it back. And, you know, we'll see. Our notions of terroir in Burgundy are so, you know, fixed in
right.
concrete that it's hard to get a lot of...
specifically Burgundy.
You know, you get cool producers more than you get new cool terroirs.
But. Right. Now, Ficin is... I always make my guests spell stuff out as F-I-X-I-N, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the worst at French. But go back for a second, because one of the things that I like to get at of people is a lot of people don't drink Burgundy because of accessibility, because of price.
Because of price, yes.
You know, it's crazy, but the whole point of your story was they're making... Tell me a little about what the story is about, Savigny-les-Bains.
Well, yeah, Savigny-les-Bains is a, it's kind of off the beaten trail in Burgundy when you think of the great town. Savigny doesn't really come up, neither does Bone itself, that for that matter, for wine. And because these places don't quite have the status of, you know, Gevrey-Chambertin or Volnay or, you know.
Vigne-Neuilly-Saint-Georges, you know, which has a name.
Yeah, even if of these other places, they tend to get ignored at least by collectors and the people who drive up the prices because they're after the big names, the trophies. So that leaves the rest of us the opportunity to, you know, drink while we can. And Savigny was really interesting to me because it's got kind of a cluster of young producers who are really working well, not only in the vineyard, but in the cellar and making wines that are just really expressive and beautiful. And some of them are already kind of mini cults themselves, like Chantreuve.
Yeah.
You know, but you can still, I mean, you know, Simon Bies has been a great producer for a long time, but in terms of pricing, it's still, you know, relative to the Burgundy scale.
So that's a great value.
Yeah.
That's a great find. I forgot the...
Chandon de Briaille. These are wonderful
ones. The
Chandrive
guy worked for Simon Bies.
Yes,
he left to concentrate there. So for Burgundy, that's an area to look for. You know, you go into your favorite good wine store.
And the, you know, there's always more. Becky Wasserman used to kind of argue all the time that, you know, we always focus on the most expensive Burgundies, but there are all kinds of far more reasonable wines. And, you know, that's true. That is definitely true. There are great... Côte de Nuit, Côte de Beaune, Bourgogne. You know, you miss out on the fun of kind of terroir analytics than saying, oh, you know, this really tastes
right.
like a Volnay or
right.
a Pomard. But
but
you've got great wines. Yes.
Yeah.
It's not so much snobby as it is just, you know, Burgundy's that sort of wine that appeals to you both, you know, soulfully and intellectually. And
true.
You know, it's at its best when you get the both elements.
True. You said you're in California. I'm curious because you said you were doing events too. Did you visit
this
any
this
wineries?
This was not so much
tasting winery tour?
No, my wine events were in, I was going to like Nantucket and Charleston and Tulsa. And
it was California wines. Yeah,
California wine. And so some really interesting thing, like Kevin Harvey at Reese, which makes very
wonderful,
good, very expensive Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Syrah, is also obsessed with the grapes of Etna, specifically Caraconte, the white grape.
Didn't they launch a project, Eris or something?
Yes, yes.
Isn't
so that's what I went to see his vineyard in the near the Sonoma coast on hills in the middle of nowhere, and was really impressed. He's also doing a Norello Mascalese and, some blends. And it's just in the formative stages, but...
Is anything in the barrel? Or?
It's already in the bottle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember getting a letter for Eris years
right.
ago.
Yeah. So, they planted the vineyards, 6 years ago or five or
right.
6 years
that
ago.
Right.
And yeah.
I mean, that's sort of an interesting trend. I mean, a guy like Dan Petrowski packed in his, big Napa cab job to make Italian whites only.
Focusing on,
he's
also, his big seller happens to be Sauvignon Blanc, so not entirely.
Right.
But, there's so many interesting things going on. I went to a place called Piscinas Ranch because now you're really challenging
me,
Sam.
Take your time.
Paicines.
Okay.
I believe is correct.
Okay.
And there's a really interesting project there in regenerative agriculture, not only in wine, but it's kind of a unified farm where they're raising animals and crops and all kinds of things. But what's really interesting is that they are experimenting with having animals in the vineyard during the growing season. Now, it's no news that a lot of vineyards will bring in sheep to the vineyard after harvest or before the grapes are
cuttings and all that.
You know, so they can eat the grass and so on. But the argument at Piscinas is actually it's really healthy for the ecosystem and the biodiversity to have the animals there during the growing season because simply the interaction of the animals and all their byproducts with the earth and it just creates so much life.
So it's
that it just improves the.
It's like the next step of regenerative, which is fairly new. But I have a question. I don't know if you know the answer or not. Do winemakers keep sheep out during the growing season because they potentially eat the grapes?
That's exactly it. You know, the fear is that they will eat the grapes, eat the leaves, damage the vines somehow. So, there's because this is an experiment almost from the beginning at Piscinas, they've trained the vines higher so that the sheep don't really reach for them. There's a similar experiment going on in Burgundy, which I visited Charles Chaud of – now I'm blanking on the name of his label, but it's noteworthy because not only is it like the single most expensive wine, or one of the most expensive wines in Burgundy right now, it's also really good. But he's
because it's limited and
it's really good.
It's good.
Yeah.
It'll come to you during the show.
Yes.
He'll yell it out.
Yeah, yeah. But he's also bringing sheep into the vineyard, and he's doing all kinds of experiments with training the vines and how they're planted, how they're staked rather than on wires. And, you know, it's fascinating, especially in a place like Burgundy, which, you know, might have been in the vanguard with biodynamics, but it's still kind of conservative in
right.
What it does.
Right. I mean, I think the world's most famous expensive wine, Romani Conti, has been biodynamic for many years.
Yes.
Forever.
And so have many of the best of them.
Right.
Domaine Arnoux Lachaux.
Oh, Lachaux.
Yes, Arnoux hyphen Lachaux.
So the wines are incredible. They're expensive, you said?
Yes. I mean, I can't possibly afford them. You know, it's like $1,500 for a Bourgogne.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, or an Aligoté.
Does he make Mâconnais or is that what, you know?
No, I mean, he's got great, you know, Grand Cru vineyards too.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating what he's doing. And so I'm really interested in these experiments around wine because, you know, it's part of the future. And if you're concerned about the environment and about climate change, about the quality of agriculture and about the wine itself, these are just are wonderful to see. And, you know, I'm not an agronomist. It's sometimes difficult for me to judge exactly you know, the effect of this sort of viticulture on the earth. You know, how does it last? How does it function in a drought? I mean, there's a healthy debate that goes on among people who are all very concerned with farming and are very conscientious. But to me, you can certainly taste in the wine, you know, the quality of farming.
Yeah, I mean, our friend Raj Parr in Cambria, way north of Santa Barbara,
yes,
has introduced animals, chicken.
Well, you know, he's also on my list, and I had wanted to visit him last year, but he was in Europe when I was in California.
I did visit, and it's worth a visit. Yeah. So you should do that because it plays into everything we've been discussing.
Yes.
In a bit, I want to talk to you about natural wine, and we'll come back to that. But you had mentioned to me that part of your traveling, and I want to kind of close that section, you were in London.
Yes.
And, you know, London is not a big wine growing mega, but tell me what was going on in London.
Well, you know, we've been shut up largely for however many years. How many years is it? It's almost 3 years now.
Coming to March.
You know, the last year opened up somewhat. And I kind of got in the habit of writing about wines that you can buy at the store or, you know, order on the internet and have delivered.
You were forced to that.
You know, I would like, you know, in the next year to be writing more about going out to drink wine in restaurants and wine bars. I did a piece recently on New York wine bars. I thought of the piece in London because, you know, there's a kind of a healthy competition between New York and London as two of the greatest places in the world to drink wine. You know, neither one of us neither city is at the center of a historic wine growing area, although both are fairly close to more modern wine areas.
Right.
And so, you know, not being in the historic habit of drinking, you know, the local produce, you got wine from all over the world, which led to very discerning populations. And, you know, it's hard to think of cities where you have more options of better wines than London and New York.
Paris, but I mean London.
Well, Paris is extremely French-centered. And
right.
You get great French wines, but you're not going to find great South African wines
for
the most part. Or even American wines, which you can find in London.
Good point.
So I went to London and I thought, I'll just do a piece of the best places, or not the best places. Let me rephrase that. Great places,
right,
to drink wine. And so I did it should be out maybe by the time we're posted here.
That's
it should scheduled to be out next week.
Okay, so we're talking first
full week of January.
We're talking early, mid-ish January.
Yeah, whenever.
Did places like Noble Rot or
Noble
Pall
Rot's
Mott
in it?
Fell on,
what's the second
is
one?
Is it Pall Mall?
No,
it's kind of fancy.
67 Pall Mall is it's not fancy.
Club?
It's a private club,
right,
which
so
is
access.
A great place to drink wine, but not really, that's another story, maybe.
Right.
I wrote about restaurants, wine bars, white tablecloth places, casual places, and the only place I didn't really want to go to are the sort of, three Michelin star or even multiple Michelin star restaurants that you pretty much expect,
right,
will have good wine. But, I was in a more casual mode.
Do you, as a writer and somebody who covers, various topics within wine, and, you choose that, do you, based on what we've just been discussing, is accessibility, price, quality top of mind now? I mean, isn't it more fun to find these places or these wines than just looking at all the trophies or expensive wines or places? I mean, do you try harder?
Well, partly, price is an important element, although it's not, always a guiding principle.
Right.
Accessibility is really difficult because, a very expensive rare wine is difficult to find, but so is a very good cheap wine if it's small production. And this is always, probably
cheap wine, but good.
Yes.
Not cheap.
The single greatest complaint I get, and this is, every single week, are people who say they can't find wines that I've recommended.
But I know you think about that, based on how you write and how you shop. I know that in some of your articles, you'll taste older wines, with friends that are totally inaccessible or whatever. But a lot of the wines that you recommend, you seem to buy in the open market.
I do, but if you think of the New York Times, it's not a city newspaper. With the internet, it's a global newspaper. So, it's one thing to have people reading me in Australia or Hong Kong,
right,
or whatever. But, the wine distribution system in the United States is so fragmented. And, people who export wines or sell wines in New York don't necessarily sell them in,
right,
Chicago, much less Tucson or Oklahoma City.
That's a good point.
Or New Jersey.
Right.
And the only way that you can satisfy everybody as far as accessibility is to write about mass-produced wines, which I very occasionally do, but most mass-produced wines are not good wines.
Right.
And I've decided, in one sense, not to compromise on that element, the argument I make to myself is that wines don't always have to be accessible. It's important, though, to know that they exist. And it's important to set a standard of what a good, you know, pick your genre of wine is. So, yes, for these 15 of these 20 wines that I'm mentioning, you may not be able to walk home and, you know, stop at your local supermarket or bodega or wherever, whatever is most convenient for you to get the wine. But that's okay. I'm okay with that. Maybe you'll take a trip to New York next year and you can find these wines. Or you could order it online, or it's just good to know it exists.
I think that's a fair, healthy, realistic way to talk about accessibility. It's the wines are there, and that's important. Sometimes you can get them, sometimes you can't.
There has to be, I don't ever want to gloat, you know, to say,
I don't think it ever comes across that way.
But I would like to do is point out, and, you know, there are certain occasions where because of my job, I have access to rare or, you know, old wines that most people wouldn't. But there's some vicarious pleasure, I think, in that. I did a piece this year. I was invited to a dinner about devoted to wines that were produced during World War II. And to me, what's fascinating is not so much the wines themselves, but the history, the meaning that wine was so important to people, particularly, you know, people who were under Nazi occupation, so important that they continue to produce it no matter what the no matter how brutal the circumstances and how dangerous.
That's a testament to wine is something more than a liquid in a glass.
Yes, it says something to the cultural importance of wine.
Yeah, I mean, not a lot of things carry those ranges.
And, you know, it just so happened that the wines were great, to my surprise, because, you know, you don't think these were not known as great vintages, and they're 80 years old. But it was very emotional, and I tried to convey that in the story. And I must have succeeded to some degree, because I didn't get a lot of people saying, you know, oh, what good is this? I can't get the, you know.
They took it for what it is,
yeah.
You know, which was an observation and an opportunity to taste and talk beyond the liquid in the glass. Just for people, because, you know, your stories are archived. When did you write that?
That, I believe, was in September
of this year,
2022.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it was, I remember seeing it. I'm not sure if I read it, but that's, you know, we can go back to that.
Homework.
Yeah, I have a lot of homework. All right. So I had mentioned to you, I wanted to ask you a broad question, and I wanted to ask you because of, you know, what you do. And I want to know what issues, stories, wines, regions, winemakers you think will be in the news or covered this coming year, you know, and why. I think a lot of the things we talked about, regenerative farming, certain regions and all that, but climate change, I mean, are there things that are going to be stories because they should be stories?
Well, climate change and viticulture, I think, are always going to be stories now, even if we have
more than ever.
Yes, because it affects everything now, you know, whether it's drought or flooding or hail or all of the things that are happening because of the climate crisis. You know, that affects us, fires every year.
This has all happened, and they will continue.
And they will continue
and be
to
covered.
Happen. And, you know,
that's part of our wine
how
life.
We adapt to it.
Right.
You know, then there are things specific to the last couple of years, the supply chain question, bottles. You know, probably the story that I wrote last year that got the most attention was about was the problem with wine bottles, which are kind of ecological disasters.
Crazy. And some wineries use double the glass.
And, you know, in some strange ways, I think we're going to go back, just as we have in agriculture where, you know, the most far-seeing farmers are going back to, you know, the pre-chemical farming days, which is the way things were done forever. You know, I think at some point we're going to have to go back before the single-use glass and single-use plastic days, when people reused jugs and you know, you didn't have the kind of waste and problems that we do now. And
I don't think people realize bottles is such an issue. You know, you think about, you know, regenerative agriculture, sustainability, but bottles
right.
falls.
I mean,
right
the production and transport of glass bottles is the occupies a single biggest carbon footprint in any wine's production and
is that true?
Distribution. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize.
Yeah. And so, you know, the solutions are going to have to come, and that's going to require people to learn new behaviors to kind of get used to inconvenience in a way that, you know, we all think we can't adapt, but we always can.
Yeah, so I hope that. I was in Uruguay about 4 years ago, invited by the government to drink wines. And I was at a small winery sitting outside with a winemaker. It was a woman. And people were just pulling up with big jugs, filling up with wine. I think it was the economics there, but in reality, it was...
That's the way things used to
be. They weren't $7.50.
Yeah,
I mean,
Demijohns.
Yeah, I mean, we're not close to wineries, but we're going to have to figure a way to, you know, compromise on
but
all
you,
that.
But, you know, I always feel more comfortable looking back at, you know, how we got here than...
We did it without cell phones, without fancy bottles, right?
Looking forward at what's going to happen is always a little uncomfortable. But one thing I would predict is that you're going to get a lot of stories. I've already seen them, in fact. People are going to say, oh, the rosé trend is going to die, or natural wine... What natural wines aren't cool anymore, and... You know, people who attribute everything to fashion and trendiness are ready for the next thing.
Right.
But people who see kind of inherent value in natural wines, and I think most the hardest core of its fans and the most important part of its constituency are deeply believe in it. They don't just feel
I think that's fancy. That's the core, and I want to get into that a little more. But just staying on stories for the coming year, what about emerging regions? I picked up somewhere where you talked about Chile.
Well, I was just going to mention Chile.
You know,
this is again related to the natural wine phenomenon, where you have places like Chile, Australia, where, you know, where they've made like they've done really good business as wine producers by just producing, you know, oceans of solid wine, maybe a lot of it's mediocre, a lot of it's uninteresting, and what is really considered good is on the very, you know, polished, sleek, high end of things. And in both places, I think in the last 10 years or so, the most interesting wines coming from it that are enough to, you know, anybody who is kind of, you know, dismissive of Australia or of Chile, maybe even of Argentina, should be try tasting some of these wines, which I think are wonderful and fascinating and just direct and adorned wines that are just so good.
What opened my eyes was I attended Raw Wine this past year, and I think there were 15, 18, 20 Chilean producers.
Yeah.
You know, when you see that, you go, there's something going on. I remember years ago, Eastern Europe, it's like, you know, what are they, even though they've been making wines forever.
I'll mention another place. Abruzzo in
Italy.
In Italy, on the East Coast, on the Adriatic. Is it on the Adriatic or
not
is it
sure.
the Aegean? Now I'm blanking.
Something with an A.
Yeah. Right? On the East Coast. But, Abruzzo has been another place that is known for big companies making kind of routine wines. And in the last 10 or 15 years, there have been a bunch of younger producers who are farming better, making wine more conscientiously, and really kind of
a lot of them are women too.
Reintroducing the world to things like Montepulciano,
right.
d'Abruzzo, Pecorino, Trebbiano,
which is terrific white wine. Pecorino,
yes, Trebbiano d'Abruzzo,
right.
Which people were dismissive of before, or just thought, okay, that's cheap wine. That's good if I get a pizza or whatever.
You're seeing it on restaurant wine lists. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Chile and Abruzzo, those are two good ones. All right, Eric, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk to you. I want to get into natural wine a little more and cover a few other things. We're talking to Eric Asimov. Eric is the wine critic for the New York Times. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, Master Cheesemaker Program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Eric Asimov. Eric, I won't let you leave the room without talking to you further about natural wine. And we've been talking about it in and out for the past half hour. What I'm curious about is natural wine and you. And by talking about natural wine and you, you know, we'll talk about natural wine. But I want to talk in the context of your recognition of it, you know, consumption, your view of it. You mentioned to me off air, it wasn't defensive, but it was a quick response. It was, hey, I've been drinking and covering this stuff for 20 years. I think you and I agree that it's, I hate to use the word vogue, but it's come into prominence.
Oh, absolutely.
Within the last decade.
Yes.
But when did this get traction, you know, with you? And was there a time like, hey, there's something going on here, but I don't know if I could write about this or?
I don't think so. I've been writing about it from, you know, from my first experience of it.
So
I don't even
me.
Know that we called it natural wine.
But tell me what that was or
back
about
in,
when.
In 2003, okay. I was writing a column called $25 and Under, and that, you know, looking for inexpensive, unusual restaurants around the city. I went to a place
it
called—
It was a restaurant.
It was
column,
a restaurant
more
reviews,
than wine, yeah.
I went to a place called 360 in Red Hook. And 360— in retrospect, was a seminal restaurant.
The OG.
Instrumental in establishing the New York natural wine culture. And the proprietor, a guy named Arno Ehrhardt, he also had a guy named Jorge Riera working there, another guy named Laurent, who now makes wine in the Loire.
Sayard, but, I forgot his last. Laurent Sayard, or I believe that's it.
And Arno would like walk around, and if he thought you were likely, would like hand you a glass of wine and say, "Try this." And he gave me a glass. I think back now, it was like.
Oh, wait, go backwards for a second. Don't lose your thought. Why did you go in there? Because you heard about it, or
it had nothing to do with wine.
It was the 25 and under.
Yeah.
Silly me. I'm sorry. Right. So go ahead. Which is crazy.
And it happened to be like a really cool little bistro in Red Hook.
Right. Which then was really nowhere.
Yeah. And he gave me a glass of what I now think is like the cult wine of natural wines, Auvergnat Rhône, Sauvignon. And
it is.
It was like, I was like, oh my God, what is this? Sauvignon. And I just assumed he said Sauvignon Blanc.
Right.
Doesn't taste like any Sauvignon Blanc I've ever had. And the restaurant itself was great. I remember I gave it a rave
the meal
review.
Was great.
You can like read that review on the internet somewhere.
Yeah.
2003, but it got me really interested in these wines. And I think
so. You literally walk out of there, sort of enlightened and with an open mind, looking forward, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was nothing. We didn't refer to natural wine.
And it wasn't
at the
everywhere
time.
At all.
No, not at all. And I started writing about wine full time the next year. And one of the early stories I did was what I considered, you know, this wine counterculture, this subculture that had its own like wine distributors like Louis Dressner, its own restaurants like 360, and its own chat boards like a place called Wine Therapy years
ago.
That's so
funny.
And, to me, it was fascinating, and the wines could be really good. And, I followed it since then as, as stories came up a little bit more about this thing called natural wine, when people like Robert Parker kind of, reacted viciously and peevishly about it, and much of the industry did as it got more popular, the debate about whether you need a definition or not,
right,
whether there has to be some official body. All of these things to me have been interesting stories. But the most interesting thing is that the natural wine over the last 20 years has been the single most influential force in wine. Around it. And, people tend to think of natural wine as simply, you don't put anything in it. You're farming organically or
smelly,
some
cloudy, orangey stuff or
too.
Something.
But think of everything else that has come with natural wine. First of all, the attitude of many early natural wine producers was, we're not part of this kind of wine establishment. We're not dealing with like reviews and scores and tasting notes. We're not like really interested in the bureaucracy and getting their approval. So you have this kind of subversive attitude. And what else? Wine marketers and a lot of wine authorities have argued for years against, you can't have like dozens and dozens of different grapes because that's too complicated. Consumers need simplicity. So we want to simplify. So our little region in Italy becomes known for a single grape. And, Instead, you have natural wine producers saying, no, these grapes are our heritage. We're not all going to grow Sauvignon Blanc here or, you know, Merlot or Cabernet.
And they're field blending them too.
Yes, we're gonna grow what has always been grown here, and in that way, natural wine people have saved dozens, if not hundreds, of indigenous grapes from being ignored into extinction.
That's a point people don't think about.
No,
but they worked hard and towards that.
And one more element is just basically taking wine off the pedestal. You know, so much of wine culture, especially in mid-century America, was devoted to, you know, wine. It's you have to be a connoisseur to understand all of these different grapes in different places and the aromas and the flavors, and you know, you have to inhale deeply and swirl
the castavan around your neck and
no it's just a drink, and you can drink it out of juice glasses if you want. You can drink it at the bar. You can sit around and party with your friends and drink good wine. What's important is that it tastes good, not that you can name 36 kinds of figs that you can, sense in the aroma.
Right.
So all of these elements have been so constructive in our wine culture over the last 20 years. And the people who are still talking about like cloudy, stinky wines, or, what if my wine's not natural? Does that make it unnatural? Or, these arguments that they're so pointless.
So has natural wine shifted from a movement to it's here now and this is part of what wine is? And my second question, and I think I talk to you a little about this off air. For the sake of saving grapes, which we just discussed, farming, shouldn't all wines be made, naturally? I mean, you ticked off a few things, economics and all of that. But first things first, is it still a movement or it's here?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say if it ever was a movement.
Thing? I mean,
one of the tensions in natural wine, as in politics, is between people who want to organize, that is define, create a bureaucracy that will consider these things and so on. And people who say, no, part of the beauty of natural wine is its lack of organization and lack of definition. And, I'm pretty much in the second camp because I believe it's true in wine. The more you try to simplify things, the more industrial things become.
Agreed.
I mean, it's probably true in economics. It's true in agriculture. The more species that you eliminate.
These are not simple subjects.
You then have a monoculture, and that's kind of the path to destructiveness as far as the environment goes. So I think it's really healthy to have a lack of organization in natural wine.
Like politics, there's tension between, right. Yeah, I mean, there is tension. I think that will continue.
This also prevents it from scaling up. So, you see that now where people are trying to
have the moniker of natural.
Greenwashing, essentially, where they want to call something natural, but it's not.
Right, 800,000 bottles.
Right. So, I mean, you can still, you can use that as a guide. If people are making millions of bottles and calling it natural, it's probably not.
Right. Right.
And to answer your question of whether all wine should be natural, I mean, you know, natural wine is an ideal. And, you know, it works on a smaller scale. When you make things on an industrial scale, it's kind of hard to keep your ideals. You know, you cut costs, you make compromises, particularly when you get corporate. And, you know, we live in a world where the vast majority of wine is produced by corporations, where you're not
just
answering.
Like food.
Yes.
Processed.
So, you know, we have big ag and we have big wine. And, you know, who are you answering to? Accountants, mostly.
Right. That doesn't fare well for the universe, but that's the way it is. So, moving on, I'm curious about your reader today. You know, you've been writing for a long time. When you sit down and write, who are you writing to? I mean, who's the audience? I would guess it's guys like me that were younger and stuck with you and are older. Is there an infusion of younger readers? You know, you and I talked about how you get input, you know, online and mail and all that, you know, so you have a sense of that. I mean, when you sit down and write, do you have to be conscious of this? Or,
well,
and how has it changed?
You know, yes, you have to be conscious of the fact that, you know, I'm now an older person. I'd like to say I'm still middle-aged, but I'm inching up there.
We're the new middle-aged.
And, you know, to answer your question, I don't really sit down and write for any specific reader. I'm writing for what I imagine are intelligent, curious people who want to know more about wine, who want to drink better wine. But it, you know, the Times readership really ranges far from people who know a lot more about certain aspects of wine than I might, to people who just want to know what to buy at the store on their way home. So you have to find a way of you know, spanning that that those groups. And what I hope to do is varying the subject, not being too repetitive, I hope, but also, you know, being conscious that there are a lot of older Times readers, but there are a lot of younger Times readers too. And so I'm not going to, like, you know, infuse my articles with a bunch of, like, you know, late boomer references.
Right. You're going to be true to yourself.
And I'm also,
but you're going to recognize.
Know, but I'm also not going to, like, pander to people by adding references that I, or language that are completely unnatural to me.
Thank
you know?
God. But so, move away from the question for a second and just apply it to wine. Have we seen the demographics of wine change? I mean, is there a younger wine drinker? Are they consuming as much, less? I mean, what do you know from your travels and what do you see? I mean, the consumer is still there, but there's new people. Do the new people do what the older people did? I mean, how is that?
Well, the economics of wine today are a lot different than they were when I was younger.
How?
and especially when people older than me were getting into wine.
Right.
And basically, wines, good wines at every price range cost more relative to what they did 20 years ago and 40 years ago. So that means that the entry level is a lot higher barriers are a lot higher for younger people who presumably don't have as much disposable income.
I mean, champagne's a great example.
Well, you know,
you can get a reasonable Sauvignon Blanc.
You know, wine by the glass at a restaurant is a good example, because, you know, what in New York City, you're paying $15 to $20 for a glass of wine in a restaurant. I mean, that's insane.
That's crazy.
And, you know, for that same and mostly wines by the glass are going to be sort of mediocre, unremarkable wines. And for that same price, you might get a cocktail that's mixed by somebody who really cares about cocktails using like
crazy ingredients.
You know, or you might get a great craft beer. Mm. And I think younger people today are far more discerning than I was at that age. You know, when I was getting out of high school in the 70s, late 70s, I had, you had like Budweiser and Miller. You know, there were two
Schlitz.
Right. Yeah. You know, there were a few beers, and they were all the same.
And then those all had a cheaper version,
right.
And that was it.
And then you had, you know, there was one kind of olive oil and one kind of coffee. And, you know, nowadays people grow up, you know, I mean, forget about wine. There's dozens of different kinds of beers. There's, you know,
crazy.
How many different kinds of single origin chocolate or olive oil
bitters.
Or vinegar or soap. And honey, I mean, all of these things, you know, people are, more used to having to make decisions and to see the fine differences. So in a way, I think people are ready to learn about wine, but it's overcoming that economic barrier that is there for a lot of young people. And
other options.
Yeah,
other interesting options.
The Silicon Valley Bank in California, which is very involved in wine economics,
study.
They do a annual report. And in 22, their annual report was focused on the danger to the wine industry of not attracting enough younger people. That, you know, an overwhelming proportion of the buyership for wine were still boomers and aging Gen Xers.
I think they suck at it. They either do nothing about it or they suck at understanding that demographic.
Well, you know, my quibble with their proposed solution, they propose that you have to come up with a good marketing campaign, like the milk industry's Got Milk of, you know, 20 years ago, whenever that was. My feeling is that younger people they're interested in social justice, in diversity, in
their story,
in the environment, in climate change, all kinds of things that the wine industry has never paid a lot of attention to, but is positioned to take advantage of from a marketing scheme, if they actually did focus on it and do something about the issues
right.
that confront the industry itself.
Yeah.
And
That's
don't worry about scores. Don't worry about, you know, in California or wherever making like knockoffs of expensive Napa Cabernets, make accessible wines, and you're seeing more of that.
And people want to know the story about the farming, about the winemaking, you know, about a sustainability effort and all of that. I think it'll definitely shift to that, hopefully, where it'll make a difference. Lastly, before I subject you to our wine list, I just want to ask you a process question, your process. A lot of the columns you write are subjects we've been discussing for the last hour, but a good chunk of them are wine recommendations, compilations, wine turned to 20, 12 Chardonnays, rosé. Tell me about the process. I mean, how do you come up with the themes? Is it obvious? Is it timely? and how do you select the wines? And I only ask that because I think that's a big thread in your fabric if you, you know, read, you know. So I think, I go, how's this guy doing all this?
Well, it's important, I think, because people would like to know what's out there. They'd like to know what's worth drinking. And a lot of it comes through my own interests, like just in the last year. And, I guess I'm a little bit of a contrarian too. So if people say, you know, oh, California Chardonnay, I don't drink that. Or Bordeaux, it's so uncool. You know, things like that.
So stay with the Chardonnay, because I think that's a good example of what you're trying to say. There's a perception California Chardonnay is big, buttery, popcorn-y, heavy, and all of that. There's been a shift away from that in wine in general everywhere. People like that style, but other people. So the point of your Chardonnay column and recommendation was to offer people opportunities to look at wines that were not that. Is that accurate?
Which happens to be my taste. I don't really go for the buttery, extravagant
Chardonnays.
But
that guy knows he's going to drink Rombauer or something. So the guy who's on the fence is going to listen to you.
There's also a lot of people who might miss the fact that there are a lot of Chardonnays from California that don't fit into that. That don't fit that stereotype. That are actually might be more appealing to you, given your taste. So you know, my task then is to find these wines that I feel and taste a whole bunch of them. So I'm picking wines that I'm enthusiastic about and can recommend without reservation.
Is it typical where, like on the Chardonnay thing, I think the story was 12 wines. You tasted 20, 30, 40. I mean, does it go deep or not necessarily?
It probably doesn't because I know enough to be able to pre-select. So I'm not going to pick out wines that I know are not going to fit what I'm looking for.
Right. So, but there's more than 12.
Yes.
You know.
You know, there might be.
You have to narrow
probably get
sometimes.
12 out of 20.
Yeah. Okay.
And then in a recent case, I just wrote a piece on sparkling wines that I, end of year sparkling wines.
Right.
And I decided to, I picked 14 because there were so many good ones. I didn't want to cut it back to 12. But then, they couldn't find one bottle for photography. So I had to, it ended up 13.
You got forced
so,
back
you know,
to 13.
Sometimes how the sausage is made is not pretty, but.
Yeah, I would think sparkling wine would be challenging because there's so many regions that are making great sparkling wines. I mean, you could do
always.
That column on any one region. You
Absolutely.
Could probably pick 10, 12 Cavas or Sex or
so,
whatever.
You know, I try to, I probably, you know, there you're kind of compelled sometimes just by, you know, to do a Thanksgiving column every year or sparkling wine column every year. And I can do the same. I can do a sparkling wine column over 5 years and not pick the same wine over 5 years. In a sense, it's cumulative because I'm trying not. I don't believe like in great bottles. I believe in great producers.
You also mentioned you don't believe in great bottles. You believe in great producers.
I mean, there are great bottles.
No, I know. But you've also talked about drinking a wine that's good. You know, it's not the most famous or exceptional, but the circumstance and environment uplifts the experience.
Absolutely.
The fact that the wine was there and it was good enough, it was memorable.
Context is everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think wine is one of those things that, you know, fits into that category, which is a really nice thing. All right. Lastly, after doing this so long, I mean, do you still feel you have some challenges? Do you feel, do what I'm doing, or I got to think of new things? I mean, what do you think about, you know, 2023, you know, what do I have to do, or how do I keep it fresh, or do
you have to look at new things? And I think, you know, I'm always curious and I'm always trying to learn more. And as long as I have that feeling of curiosity
still
and,
there.
And exploration.
Because you exhibited that with the natural wine story, the Brooklyn story. You know, hopefully you'll that same.
No, I absolutely feel that way.
Okay.
And, you know, if I were to get bored or just blasé about wine, I'd have to do something else because.
And we're not there at all, right?
No, I mean, not
at all.
There's
so much going on, you know, to do that excites you, that's interesting, right?
You know, I reviewed restaurants for 12 years, and yeah, I got a little tired of doing that. And I thought, I don't really want to keep doing this. I've been writing about wine for more than 20 years, and I'm never tired. I find it, the subject is fascinating in so many different ways, whether,
I agree.
You know, history, culture, personality, aesthetics.
Right. I believe there's so many more aspects,
yeah.
You know, to wine that, you know, all require a lot of time, which I'm glad to hear that because I don't want you to go anywhere.
And I also feel that I have more to say about it, and I'm not just repeating myself. I'm not, struggling to find new ways of saying the same old thing.
Well, that's important, but it's also a tribute to the topic. There's so much, you know, going on that requires different attention or, you know, no.
And there are a lot of ways to say virtually the same thing in different ways.
Right, right. All right, we're not going to let you leave without doing our wine list. We're almost done here. 5 questions. As I mentioned to you, I've asked everyone that's been on this show the same 5 questions. So don't think this is hard. I don't think you're special. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that's in the context of what's in your fridge. What are you trying? Maybe it relates to work. Maybe it's the change of seasons. Just a couple of things that you're knocking around.
I drink everything, honestly.
Okay,
but
so that's the first
what
answer.
What I'm really curious about right now is the 2021 vintage across Europe. 2021 was a really kind of bad
was
year
in terms of weather. Was that the frost vintage where you saw the pictures of the...
There was frost, there was hail, there was rain. I mean, it was a tough year. And in a lot of ways, it was a throwback year to pre-climate change. You know, you had 18, 19, 20 very hot years, regardless of where you were, really. And then you had this, like, chilly, wet year. And some of the wines that I've had from 21 are great. I mean, part of the problem when you have a year like that is that yields are low.
Right.
So there's not a lot of it. But, you know,
and
you're
also
making...
not everyone will make a great wine.
Yes,
but
not
the good
everyone
makers
will make a great
make.
Wine. But good producers had an opportunity to make wines in styles that they haven't had for, a long time. Very transparent, weightless kinds of wines. Just to mention one, and I hope to write a story about this in the next few months as more of them come online, but the Cabernet Riesling. You know,
Cabernet is a drier Riesling,
well,
right?
Well, not precisely. In Germany, the dry Rieslings have been in style now for a long time, and you know they in my experience in Germany, very few people are drinking Rieslings with any kind of modicum of sweetness to them. So it's largely an export market. But if you have a sweet Riesling, there are certain degrees related to the ripeness of the grapes when they were harvested. So
right.
Cabernet is sort of a moderate sugar content. Spätlese, a little
sweeter.
More sugar.
Right.
Auslese, more still and very sweet. But recently, you haven't been able to make a classic Cabernet style because of climate change, where it just gets too warm and that you can't harvest the grapes at a modest sugar level.
So the cooler weather is benefiting them?
Well, in 2021, and I have a lot more research to do, but my impression is that, you know, this is a style that of people, and I was introduced to Cabernet Riesling in the 80s and really enjoyed it, loved it. And then, you know, in the 2000, beginning in 2000, early 2000s, you couldn't really find that style anymore, right, even if it was called Cabernet.
Interesting. I'm looking forward to reading more about that. It basically affected all of Europe, right? I mean,
yeah.
France, Italy, you know, Germany, I'm sure other regions. That's interesting. So you're drinking through 21s. All right, second question, we'll move along. This is the goofiest question on the list. As the new year comes upon us, I'm wondering whether to leave it on. But the question is, favorite wine and food pairing?
Oh, yeah, forget it. I don't care about wine and food pairings.
But I get that. But is there something like wine is good with? Like I remember reading, you were talking about champagne and you said it's great with fried food and pizza,
yes,
and all the classics. You so know, that's a good pairing.
Or tomato, if you're making a tomato sauce, cooked tomato sauce. My wife and I have a tradition of having lasagna on New Year's.
Okay.
And
you make it?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's just great with Chianti Classico.
That's a perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to take that because somewhere within the resistance is an answer or whatever. But that's a good one. It's actually perfect. All right. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And I'm going to take the word favorite out. And I want to disclaim it that if you choose to answer this question, that these are just some places. You're not leaving people out and you're not listing them as your number one and two, but would you be willing to tell me some places out there that in the context of wine have the list, the knowledge, the environment that are just, you know.
Well, let's just talk about new places.
Fine.
In New York.
Fine.
Places that I've been to.
That's
over,
all I care about,
that
you've experienced
year.
Them, yes. Not read about.
Well, Claude.
I told
great.
You he was on the show, Chase.
Yes. It's a terrific restaurant.
That falls into your story in writing about wine bar.
Well,
restaurant,
I don't think
wine,
it's a wine bar.
Right.
But and we'll talk about restaurants first. Chambers, great.
Pascaline.
Le Roc, Jorge, loved that place. I'm not really sure how to pronounce this. The Nordwick. Nordwick.
That's
yeah.
Cedric, I forgot, Nisse's Nikkei
yes.
from
yes.
11 Madison.
Yes. Really good. And then Lords and Dame.
The
fantastic.
Ed Szymanski.
Yeah.
Is Lords wine better than Dame? Did he up the game or both of them were
well,
always good?
You know, I love both of them, but they're very different. Lords has a much deeper kind of selection.
Is that because of the food or you think his second time around he said, here's a chance to get it?
I don't
even.
Know.
Yeah, I think
I don't
it's
know.
A little of all of
I don't
that.
Know.
It's fun. What else?
Well, I have to kind of remember, but there are some great wine bars. Parcel
just opened
great
recently.
Wine bar.
Yep.
Another one, not too far away on the Lower East Side, and I'm blanking on
Gem?
The name. Gem. Yes, Gem Wine. It's I really like that place because the wines are the place is simple.
The food is good,
but it's also simple. You know, you're not going there for a full-fledged cooked
right.
meal.
Right.
You know, they're not giving you trophy wines. They're for the most part all under $100. And I really appreciated that approach. Place des Fêtes.
Yes.
In
got great
Clinton
notices.
Hills. Excellent.
It's funny how all these places are incredible, and they're not under a specific category like wine bar. Jem may be a wine bar, but they have great food. You know, Claude may be a restaurant, but it's as good a wine, you know, place as any.
Yeah.
The diversity. And a lot of these places are new, which indicates sort of a renaissance, you know, in New York, and the fortitude of these people to open in hospitality, you know, after a tough time.
Runner up in Park Slope.
Yeah.
I
love Daniel Eddy.
Just
his
great
food.
Great
and,
food. Yeah. Simple food. Great food.
Yeah.
Great wine list.
Runner up is the wine bar restaurant to winner, which was his COVID, you know, window takeout.
Yes.
Terrific. Those are all great choices. And I didn't mention this, but I post all this on social media.
I should mention Gus's from the Pepino
Gus's Chop
people.
House. Yeah. My buddy, James.
Yes.
Who is also Popina, which is also a fun wine place.
Yes.
There's just so many, you know, great places. And you covered a lot of them. All right. Fourth question. When I initially structured this question, and I'm not sure how I positioned this to you when we did it, because you were on a few years ago, and we don't do this at Charleston. The question was favorite all-time wine. And the initial idea for me was, hey, Eric, what's the rarest, most expensive wine you ever drank? And I don't give a crap about that anymore. I morphed away from that. What I realize is the question is really, can you identify a wine or two, a wine that's been important to you, a gateway wine, an enlightening wine, a wine that changed the way you thought? You sort of answered it, because when the guy at, 360, the place in Red Hook, handed you that, that kind of falls in this category. So how do you answer that?
Well, you know, for me, it's not been... Not to sound like a Hallmark card, but wine is a journey, and you're constantly learning, and you know, new bottles open up new points of view and new directions. And I mean, this goes back to like the very beginning of my interest in wine. You know, when I was in graduate school in Austin, Texas, and by accident, you know, bought a bottle of Barbera d'Alba.
Do you remember the maker?
Yes. It was 1978 Giacomo Conterno. And I never heard of Giacomo Conterno. And, you know, it was probably like a $7 bottle in 1982. And I remember drinking it and just like being blown away and having, you know, it was like, oh my God, I had no idea wine could be this good. I have to find a way to have this experience again and again. So you start getting interested in wine. And my pathway into wine has nothing to do with the greatest or rarest or most profound bottle. These are the simple bottles that you have almost by accident. I remember I used to, you know, I'd be very influenced by things that I read, you know, like people
it
in a
novel.
It
would draw you to that? Or?
And I remember in reading a novel and somebody was drinking like a Moselle. They called it Moselle. They used
right?
the French spelling
right.
of the German wine.
Right.
And I got to check that out.
That's funny.
Oh, my goodness. That's really good. It was J.J. Prüm Cabernet Riesling, Grocker Himmelreich.
You know, very, very solid.
I remember the first time I had a Burgundy, and it was in Eau Côte de Nuit, Guillaume.
So really, the reality is that those experiences are way more important than just sitting there and drinking whatever, a 45 Romani Conti or 61 Petrus,
yes,
which are all great. But.
Because, I mean, this is how you, all of these are important because that's how you develop your own context and your own taste.
Right.
So I remember, you know, the first time I had like a so-called great, you know, classically old great wine, I bought a bottle of... This goes back
70s?
30, no, not like.
Not college time, later.
Maybe 1989 or 1990, I bought a bottle of 1955 La Mission Aubryon because my parents were married in 1955, and it was their wedding anniversary.
How,
must have been their 30th. How
was it?
30th? Maybe it was their 30th, maybe 85. And it was just magnificent.
Was that, when you look back, if you look back, was 55 considered a good vintage? Or?
Well, that wine was considered a great wine. 55
regardless
was
of the vintage, a good
55
maker.
55 was potentially a very good vintage, but there were inconsistencies. But the La Mission was renowned. And I remember, like, really just like, oh, I don't know, $200 for this, you know, 30-year-old bottle. And I swallowed and I bought it. You know, that's what I mean.
Did you drink it? As
somebody in my 20s then, I could afford to do that. Whereas now, if you wanted to get a 30-year-old bottle of, you know, well, like an 82 or whatever.
82 any Bordeaux.
No, you'd be spending thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And, you know, you couldn't possibly.
You can get a Lynch Bage for $1,000, but you're not getting a Latour.
Right.
You know, or the.
Or La Mission.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. That's a good answer. All right, last question. And I think you should be as good as anybody to answer this. No pressure. But the last question has always been, recommend to me the best wines you could think of around 15, 20, 22 bucks, a red and a white. You can go category, like Muscadet is a good value. And I'm very repetitive. My kids are in their mid, late 20s. They can't afford to go to a dinner party and bring all the crappy wine we've been talking about, supermarket industrial wine, but they can't spend 50.
No.
You know, so how do you wow with 20,
this
19,
is,
22?
There's the way, here's how I would answer that. I'm going to recommend finding the best wine shop available. This means not a supermarket, not a big box store. You might find special buys in these places, bargains, but only if you know what you're doing. So you want to go to like a wine shop where they care, they're incredibly passionate about their wine. They're like, you know, going to what we used to call indie record shops,
right?
You know, where you might get like in an argument, you know, okay, I have $15. Just bring me the most interesting red wine or white wine. Is it if you're pairing it with a dinner? Okay, we're having
meat,
you know,
or
we're
pasta
having spaghetti
or whatever,
tonight,
right?
With red sauce. This is, what do you think? Or chicken, or you know, Chinese food, or whatever. And that's how I would answer that question, because it's no one thing. I would never say, oh, you know, you got to buy like a Muscadet or a, you know. I would never pick one
even
genre,
though Chianti
Classico
goes great with lasagna on New Year's, and it's a terrific wine in value.
Yeah, but not for maybe not for $15,
right?
And you know, because the chances are that you're going to end up with a wine from a place you never heard of, maybe even from a grape you never heard of. Because the way wines stay cheap is by lacking status,
right?
And right. And so you need somebody who's truly educated to clue you in to what that is.
I totally agree with that, and I've always you know, pushed that idea. And I have a feeling that the last time you were on the show years ago, that may have also been your answer.
Maybe.
And I think that was enlightening to me, because even though I do it and it made sense, you know, for you to kind of walk it through out loud, you know, like if you go to Brooklyn, it's easy to walk into a cool wine shop and find that experience. It's that guy in No Fun of Kansas City or Akron. But there are people out there that are curating this stuff. And you, one thing you neglected to mention, which you know, is you have to be expressive. You have to say, I'm eating this. I like this type. Yes. I want to spend this much. You know, and the guy will put you in that profile. And if, by the way, you don't like it, you go back and say, I didn't like it. Give me something else. Or you go somewhere else.
You know, by the way, all these, you know, you find like great wine in the most unlikely places. And maybe it's, you know, it's a tribute to our own obtuseness that we think are these. But I was looking for a wine recently, and I kept finding these bottles turning up in some shop in Auburn, New York, which is, you know, way upstate. I think they have a prison there. But I, you know, you don't think of as a great wine source. And wow, I got it.
So you brought up a good point, because when I asked you the question, you said, you know what, go into your local wine shop and talk to the guy about, you know.
Good wine shop.
I meant to say that. A lot of people are shopping online. How do we apply this to online? You may not be able to, right?
Well, it's not so easy online. But, you know, one of the things about shopping online is that there you have to have some modicum of education so you can make intelligent selections, you know?
Right.
I think, you know, one of the real problems now, especially for younger people who are relying on wine apps, you know, this is we're crowdsourcing here, and this, my friends are drinking this, or I'm, you know, this is a
like peer to peer,
or we're aggregating all of the the scores in the magazines,
like
or whatever. But you're cutting out the the educated recommendation, and this is not to, you know, sometimes your friends will definitely steer you in the right direction.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just need somebody who can make some recommendations because they've tasted it all and they have, some critical faculties.
I think that's why you support your local wine shop. Online may be good for fulfillment and price, but not being pointed anywhere. I mean, I hate to say this, but you take some of the tips from your local guy and every now and then buy it online, but I'm not encouraging that.
You know, you also have to recognize that wine buying, because of there's so much available, so much unknown, that it's an adventure and it rewards exploration, but not every, not every purchase results in a reward.
Right. But you should go in that way.
I accept that.
I agree with that. All right. I mentioned it already. I will post your answers on social media. I think people are very interested in your recommendations and point of view. So in the coming week, we will post that. Quick wrap up. I want to get some info from you, Eric, and then I'm going to let you go. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. If you like the show, leave us a review. Here's why I tell you to subscribe. Eric Asimov is in your inbox as soon as the show hits. You don't have to search it, and who doesn't want to hear what Eric has to say? You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. I know that's a little confusing, but you can always get to us via the hashtag TheGrapeNation to find us on both. We are on Facebook at TheGrapeNation. As mentioned, I'll post Eric's wine list on our social media sites. If they don't know by now, we're going to tell them right now, but if they want to find all of your work, it's at the New York Times.
Yes, it's at the New York Times. It's just, you can Google it or DuckDuckGo it or whatever you... your chosen search function is?
I've been an online subscriber forever. I don't want to put you on the spot, but is any stuff available without, you know, being an online subscriber?
You know, if you're not a subscriber, you may get a certain number of free articles per month. But, you know, the cost of subscribing to the New York Times online is not great, and you get an amazing amount of content, and you support great journalism.
Well, I think the Times epitomizes that. You know, I worked with Howard Stern for 30 years, and he would always talk about how he would sit with the Times and was just amazed at how much content there was and how good it was and how he couldn't finish it. And it frustrated him. And I think anybody, you know, feels that way if, you know, they're a fan. And that certainly applies to you, you know, and wine as a topic. I've said before, you are a prolific tweeter on Twitter.
Not so much anymore.
Okay. I mean, there's reasons, and that's another show on its own. But you are on social media.
Yes.
You're on Twitter.
I'm at Eric Asimov, and that's both Twitter and Instagram. And I'm working on the posts and the mastodons and so on.
I just read about Mastodon today, and Spaces on Twitter is hot now. It's a new thing.
I don't even know what
that
is.
When you get home, you'll look that up. All right. I want to thank our guest, Eric Asimov. It's always a pleasure to sit with him. We covered a lot of ground, and I appreciate that. Thank you to our engineers and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.